Talk about the joy of giving. But before I start that, I just want to say I'm thankful for those who made this luncheon possible. We have four pork shoulders. Is David here today? Did your son count? No, where's Anita? Is he here? He's going to be here? He's going to bring them, right? How many hours does it take him to smoke them? 14? Something like that? Yeah, it's all night long. He's got to be smoking these. It's a secret, yeah. Well, I know last time he did it, he had to wake up several times in the middle of the night to go check and stoke the fire. So I'm just really grateful for David Sanchez, whose labor of love is a gift to our entire church today. We're going to have the best pulled pork sandwiches you have ever eaten. We have the rolls from the bakery in Sir Madre, and we have a proprietary recipe of coleslaw from David Rodriguez, who will never share it. I always ask him, he never shares it. One day he might repent. We'll just pray that he'll share his. Anyway, we're looking forward to this. And a nice macaroni salad from Single Sylvia and also enjoying the raffle and all that stuff. And we're hoping to raise about $1,000 today. Maybe the Lord will do that for us. So you eat for free or you eat for $5, $10, $50, whatever you want to give is fine. The Lord will provide. Okay. So the joy of giving. I have wanted to talk about this for a long time, Lupe. I've been here 5 years. Let's see, who's been here 5 years with me? Calvin, Kathy, you tell me, did you ever hear me preach? How many times did I preach about finances? 22. Liar. It was one time, I think, I have this vague memory that I preached one time on finances. The reason I'm asking that is, the reason I'm saying that is because as elders, we are very reluctant to bring up the issue of giving. One of the reasons is because we don't want to ever come across like we need your money. That's never going to be the issue. We will always deal with our ministry within what God provides. But there is a time to talk about money because the scripture demands that we talk about money. Matthew's gospel, Matthew had more parables, more sayings, more teachings from Jesus about money than any other gospel writer. And probably, Mario, it had to do with that he was a tax collector. So he was really into money beforehand. And the Lord delivered him from that. And then he wanted to talk about financial freedom. And so his whole gospel is all about financial freedom. And so today's message is not for the purpose of trying to benefit us financially, but it is for the purpose to free your heart to give with joy and find out what the joy of giving is all about. Okay, so number one, I've got 9 different observations in my mind. I just went from Genesis all the way through the New Testament to see where do I get this notion of joy of giving? How many passages are there that talk about the joy of giving? And you're going to be amazed how many things we learn today. Number one, from the beginning of time, people have made offerings to their God. From the very beginning, they have also differed in how much they honor God with their offering. There are basically two kinds of people. Those who clutch and hold on to what they have because they just, okay, you can have this, God, or that. And those who have a liberal heart say, God, I can hardly wait to give you. I want to give this offering because I'm so indebted to you. It's like two different dispositions in the heart. We see this in Genesis chapter 4. Abel, the two children of Adam and Eve, the first two sons were Abel and Cain. And Cain was the older one. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and other fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So what's going on here? Why was God not pleased with Cain's offering, but he was pleased with Abel's? Well, one of the things that we have a hint here is that when Moses describes Cain's offering, he just says an offering from the fruit of the ground. Just whatever. It was nondescript. Nothing unusual, nothing particularly generous. It was he took some grain or he took some fruit or whatever he had as a farmer, what he was working on, and he brought some of it and he gave it to God. Here's your offering. I know I'm supposed to offer something to you. Here's your gift. And God was not impressed. But when it came time for Abel, Moses describes it this way. He says he brought from the firstborn of his flock. To say firstborn is another way of saying he bought the best of his flock. He went down, and I remember having my friend Hassan. I visited him several times there in the mountains of Anatolia in Turkey. And Hassan, at one time I spent 3 days with him, and he's a shepherd. He had 120 to 160 sheep right around that amount. And when those lambs are born in the spring, and he takes them out, I mean, these are precious animals to him. I remember Hassan spending the night, like I was staying there with his son. I was friends with his son, and Hassan was maybe 15 years older than me. And Hassan said, okay, Chris, I'll see you in the morning for breakfast, but right now I'm going to spend the night in the sheep pen. So I said, well, wait, show me where you spend the night. So I went in there, and there's his barn. There's all his sheep in there on the bottom floor, and he's up on a loft with just a little cot or something. And he says, I stay here because I want to protect him. I want to make sure no animals get in. And, you know, I mean, he's got one or two of these big Congal dogs already, but there's wolves there. There's bears in that country, and so he wanted to protect them every night by sleeping right near them. He loves his sheep. And for Abel to take the best of his sheep, probably several of them, right? And he offered them. He was the first one. It's like, oh, God gave me my first offspring and my sheep and my flock. I'm going to give him the best that I have to honor him and say, thank you, God, for being with me and helping me with my flock of sheep or whatever other, just as firstborn of the flock. So it could have been cattle. It could have been other animals. And the Lord had regard for Abel, but for Cain, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your face fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance return or be accepted? Will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, then sin is crouching at the door, waiting. Its desire is to contrary you or to overcome you, but you must rule over it. And then you know the rest of the story. Cain is so angry, not only at God, but he's angry at his brother because his brother was younger than him. And Cain didn't like the fact that God appreciated what Abel gave, but didn't appreciate his offering. And instead of looking at his heart and say, well, what did I do wrong and how can I correct it? Because, you know, here the Lord is talking to him. He's not even talking to Abel. He's already taken care of Abel, but he wants to restore Cain, and Cain refuses to repent or change. And all he's thinking about is my brother. How dare he get a higher position before God than I have? And he goes out and kills him. Vastly different hearts, vastly different characters. And what we'll see in the scripture is that the way you handle finances is just about the most important factor in determining what your character is like. What do you do with your money? It has everything to say about your character. So we see in Abraham, later on in the book of Genesis, Abraham was the first man, the first patriarch, the first man of God whom God called to offer a tenth of what he had to God's representative. So what do we find out? There was a war that took place. His nephew Lot was in the city of Sodom. There was Sodom and Gomorrah in the valley. And then these five kings from the north came in and took over all the people, conquered the cities, and they took all the people captive, including Lot and his wife and his two daughters. And so they were far away up in the north, and Abraham said, I've got to save my nephew. So he took about 200 men or 250 men with him, and they conquered this army that was bigger than them. And God helped Abraham to do that. And so we find him, after his return from the defeat of Chedor, Lot, Omer, and the kings who were with him, these five kings, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the Valley of Shaveh. He was going to thank him for saving his life and for the life of his people. And then in the middle of the scene, we find this very mysterious paragraph. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High. He was not an idolater like the others. He was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed Abraham. And Melchizedek said, blessed be Abraham, the God of by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And when Abraham recognized that this is God's priest for the Most High God, I'm going to honor God by giving him a tenth, Melchizedek, a tenth of everything I have. And Abraham was a wealthy man. So it says, Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Melchizedek was the king of Salem, which means he was the king of Jerusalem. Jerusalem comes from the word Salem. So Salem was his first name. Later on, it was called Jerusalem, you know, the same word. Okay, number three, I meant to say also Jacob, his grandson. So Abraham gave a tithe, then Isaac. We find out Isaac honored God by the way he lived also. And then Jacob, when he was sent out from his parents to go to Laban and find a wife for himself there in Haran, it says that he laid down and he had a dream at night. He saw God up in heaven, or he saw these staircases of angels coming up and down, and he knew that God was there. He called the place Beth-El, which means house of God. And he said, you know what, if God is with me, if he watches over me, if he protects me, here I am with my staff only, and I'm going all the way to Haran, maybe a 3-month journey, and if I come back and he takes care of me, then I'm going to give him a tenth of everything I have. And so Jacob understood that same principle, both Abraham and Jacob. So from the time of Moses, number three, from the time of Moses, an offering was always considered voluntary. It has to be voluntary. God does not want you to give anything under compulsion. And that's one of the reasons we don't bring up the topic a lot, because we don't want to compel anyone. We're not trying to pressure anyone to give. But we do want to teach you how there is greater joy in giving than in keeping. And hopefully by our own lives, we've exemplified that to you. Moses said to all the congregation, this is before he built the tabernacle where God was going to dwell, and he says this is an amazing opportunity for the people of Israel at that time to give of whatever they had valuable to help build this tabernacle and all the things that were part of it. So Moses in Exodus, I think it's 35, I can't remember, I'll see at the end, 14, where is it? Exodus 35, yeah. This is from that chapter. Moses said to all the congregation of Israel, this is the thing the Lord has commanded. Take from among you a contribution to the Lord. Whoever is of a generous heart, let him bring the Lord's contribution. And then he goes on. This is very interesting to see the kinds of things that they would give in their offering plate. We think of money, but they gave gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarns. Because yarn was not like today. We go to Michael's, right? We pick up yarn for $5. Their yarn had to be hand-spun and hand-dyed with plants that you had to take or berries, and you had to smash them and mush them and put the thing. I mean, it was a long process. That's why an article of clothing for someone back then would be equivalent, I think, to about $1,000 now. If you had clothing, that meant you were well-to-do. If you had nice clothing with all these colors in it, or you had fine woven linen from Egypt, then it was very well. It was several thousand dollars. So gold, silver, bronze, blue and purple and scarlet yarns, and fine twined linen, right? The linen, today when did the loom start? Maybe 300 years ago, something like that, 200 years ago from the what is it called, the loom? The automatic, what do we call it? The thing that could make sheets automatically so people didn't have to weave them together. That was a huge change to make things much cheaper. So today when we buy sheets, it's just, you know, under $100, we get a set of nice sheets for our beds, right? But back at that time, they had to hand weave every single line of that cotton fabric. Goat's hair, tanned ram's skins, these are leathers, right? Really nice, expensive leathers, goat skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and stones for setting, other precious stones, and for the ephod and for the breastplate, because Aaron, when he had his clothing, he had 12 separate, special, beautiful stones to represent the 12 tribes that he was praying and interceding before God. So all the congregation of the people, they departed from the presence of Moses, and they came, everyone whose heart stirred him, okay? And everyone whose spirit moved him. So there's nothing like receiving a gift from someone who says to you, I feel compelled to give this. I want to give this. Remember when we were in the book of Acts, we saw how Lydia, the seller of purple in Philippi, she came to Christ, she was baptized, and she says to Paul, Paul and Silas and your team, I want you to stay at my house. And we know the way that Paul would have answered her is just the way he answered all the congregation. He said, no. I'm a tent maker. I work with my hands every day for 4 to 6 hours, and I take care of my needs and even my team. I'm fine. We don't need to stay in your house. We don't want to be an inconvenience to you. And it says that the word that Luke uses of her is to compel by force against nature. She said, oh no, you're not going to leave my house. You are going to stay here, Paul. As long as you think I'm a Christian and I'm faithful, then you need to stay at my house. This is a gift God gave me. I insist you must stay here. I'm going to take care of you. I'll feed you and I'll house you as long as you're here in Philippi. And so it says, then we gave in. Lupe, it was the only church who forced Paul to receive a gift. He says in Philippians chapter 4, thank you for the gift. You're the only ones in Macedonia who ever gave to me time and time again when I was in Athens and so forth. In fact, it says when he went to Corinth, he was doing his working with, Aquila on the tent making because they were both the same traders. And then it says Timothy came from Macedonia and bingo, he worked full time for the Lord as an apostle. For 18 months, the Philippians had donated him enough money, which is probably what, let's say if it was $40,000 a year for an average income, then he got $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 of gifts from this church so he could work full-time as an apostle and he didn't have to work at all. And he says, time and time again you did that. Well, it's very interesting that the same woman, Lydia, who compelled him to stay at her house, was probably the lead person to cause the entire church to say, we're going to support this man. He's an apostle. This is a unique time in history. We want to participate in the work of God. So they sent him time and time again. They sent him a gift with Epaphroditus or whoever sent it. And he says, you know what? Your gift is a fragrant aroma, a beautiful offering to God. And he calls them. He says, you have been my partner in the gospel from the first day. So there's this amazing opportunity that sometimes God gives us as believers to partner with people by giving financially when we can't go with them. We partner with them. We partner with the Lord and with his work. And that's what they were doing at this time when they were building the tabernacle. Everyone whose heart stirred them, everyone whose spirit moved them, they brought the Lord's contribution to be used for the tent of meeting, for its service, and for the holy garments. And so they came, both men and women, all who were of a willing heart. That's the fourth time he's mentioned this. Willing heart, you know, a free a desire, an inward desire and motivation. All who were of willing heart brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and armlets and all sorts of gold objects, every man dedicating an offering of gold to the Lord. Let me explain something to you about Turkey, where I lived. We didn't know this until we got there, but the Turkish women, every one of them, you can pick the poorest women out there that you know, and she will have 10 to 20 gold bracelets hidden in her bedroom. And maybe a necklace. And at least several pairs of earrings, right? Not 14 karat gold. 14 karat gold is not considered good in Turkey. It has to be 22 karat gold. And one time, I don't know if it was for you, Karen, but we were at some event and someone wanted to give, I thought it was you, they gave you a gift and they gave you two gold earrings. And at the time, I figured it out by the ounce. I mean, they're very light, but it was like $35 to $40 that she spent on those two gold earrings. This is, you know, 20-some years ago. And her income must have been about $400 a month, I think, $350 to $400. So she was giving about 10% of her monthly income to buy one gift to give and honor someone. And that's what they consider a gift. If you give something small, if you give 14 karat gold or silver, it's like, oh, come on, that's small potatoes. That's nothing. The people in the Middle East understand when you want to make a statement, you give something meaningful and something that sacrifices, that costs something, costs you something. And so these people gave up their gold and where are we? All sorts of gold objects, every man dedicating an offering of gold to the Lord. And then it goes on to say everyone who possessed acacia wood, the skillful woman spun with her hands. I mean, the whole chapter is dedicated to describing what these people came up with to help Moses and Aaron as they set up the first tabernacle, and they had the honor and the privilege of saying, I contributed this gold and I contributed this piece of acacia wood and all this wool that we had already had pre-spun and ready to make a blanket on. We gave it to them so they could make it for the tent and for some of the utensils to use in Yahweh, in the worship of Jehovah. Number four, generosity is a sign of wisdom. These are all from, well, Psalms and Proverbs here. This is an interesting verse. The wicked borrows and does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. Becky, have you ever had a friend who's asking you for financial help, and then a couple years later, again, they want some financial help, and you're wondering, why do they never get their act together? It's because they've never learned this principle. They're always asking, they're always saying, I don't quite have enough, I need more, I need more, I need more. And in fact, sometimes they don't even pay you back. If you loan money, then you may not get back. And so, I mean, I've helped many people, but I can tell those people, some of them, all they think about is today. Oh, I got money today, I'll spend it today. And they're not able to plan, to save, and to plan to give. But the righteous is generous and gives. So generosity is a sign of wisdom. Honor the Lord with your wealth. This is Proverbs 3. And with the first fruits of all your produce, the best of all your produce, right? And then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. The way Karen and I do this is that every month we get our paychecks. And I think we get together something like $8,000 in our income. And the first thing we do is take $800 and we sink it into this church. One way or the other. If the first thing I do is write a check, the other thing is I keep some cash on hand and I'm able to get all kinds of things. I buy books for the elders so that they have a commentary or the preaching team when they're going to preach through James. I want them all to have a commentary. Or I bought the drinks today from Costco. They're all from Costco. I'm spending money all the time, and I'm spending it on guess who? You. Because you are in my heart. This is the church God's called me to, and I want this local church to benefit the most from my money, from my giving, from our giving. And so I have a lot of people who tell me, hey, I'm a missionary now, would you support me? And I say, no. All right, bless you, may the Lord go with you. I'm not going to support you because I have one missionary named Olga, and that's all I can afford to support, right? And I have one man in jail, Ed Portillo, I'm going to support him. And I have one church, and that's all my money goes to them. And so I have all the time, I'm telling people, no, I can't give, I'm sorry, I'm not there, because I want to save everything I have for the people that are dearest to me and for the people God has put closest to my heart. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with your first fruits of your produce, and then your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will burst with wine. What is he saying? If you understand this principle of giving and you honor the Lord, he will take care of the needs that you have. I probably saw this never more clearly than as a missionary. What was I making? $3,300 a month, and they paid my rent. It wasn't a bad salary, but in Germany, it doesn't go a long ways. McDonald's, I think, even 20 years ago, McDonald's was $60 or $55 for us just to have a little meal. Very expensive. So anyway, as our daughters got older, I started thinking, what am I going to do about college? David, I just thought, what do I do? I'm a missionary. Okay, PCC, that's what we'll do, or Cal State LA, maybe we can do that, And so as Janelle got older, she said, Daddy, I'd like to go to Biola. Biola? Don't say it. Why did you have to pick a private Christian college? Why not something, Oh, but Daddy, it's such a good school. Okay, we'll see what we can do. And then, of course, every one of them wanted a private Christian college of their choice, all 4 years. They wanted to start as freshmen. They wanted to be in the dorms. They wanted to experience college life to the maximum, right? So Biola, what is that, $120,000? And then there's Biola again. There's three Biolas is about $360,000. And the last one is OBU. That's not $100,000. So I'm thinking about over $400,000 I'm supposed to come up with to send my four girls to college. What in the world am I going to do? God says, don't worry. Honor me. And I'll find a way to fill your vats with wine. And of all the things, I think it was the first year that Janelle was in college, or maybe even before, and we got a letter in the mail from Karen's half-brother, Eric Brewer. He started an internet company, and his lawyer wrote us a letter saying, Dear Karen, Chris, we have the pleasure of informing you that you have 5,000 shares of stock in Inc. to me, the company that your brother started and founded. We called Eric and said, hey, thank you so much. This sounds wonderful, but what's that actually worth? He said, well, it's only worth about 35 cents or 50 cents a share now, but just wait for the IPO and we'll see. We waited 6 months. The IPO happened. First day, it shot up to $42. $42 or $35, then it went up to $41, $42. And we started thinking, oh my goodness, this is a lot of money. And so I said, Karen, we don't know if it's going to go up or down. What I'm going to do is I checked with my father-in-law. He said it's a good idea. So every 3 months, I sold 2.5% of the stock on the day, the exact middle of February, the exact middle of May, the exact, 15th. And so I sent it in, and that way I didn't have to worry about the stock market. I didn't have to look at it every day and wonder. I just sent it out there, and I figured over 7 years, we'll sell everything and we'll diversify. Well, one day, I think it was on the fourth or third of the fourth sale, and the stockbroker wrote me and said, your certificate didn't come, and I can't sell it without your certificate. I said, well, I mailed it like 10 days ago. Well, it got lost in the mail. Hi, yi, yi. So finally, it arrived like a week later or 2 weeks later, and so he sold it immediately and said, oh, guess what? We just hit $220 a share today, and I sold it. Here's $53,000 in your account. I'm like, but. And then he sent me the whole portfolio saying, you have $2.3 million. Chris and Karen Crossan, $2.3 million. I didn't know what to do. I was like, this is surreal. This is crazy. Well, I kept doing it every 3 months, and the stock went up from 220. That was the day, the highest day of its history, and then it went all the way down to $1.79 when the crash hit in 2000, 2001, and then Yahoo bought the company. So altogether, we probably made $158,000 on all that stock. And I thought, God, you do miracles. And I was able to pay for Janelle and pay for Tiffany, no problem, write a check. We needed a car. I bought a car. Here's the check. And I said, Karen, this will be our car for 9 months on our furlough, on our stateside. And then when it's done, we'll ask my friend Bruce Henry if he'll maintain it, and it'll be a missionary car after that. So all the missionary families who came back, they had a beautiful Dodge Caravan that was that they could use for the whole time that they're here. And that lasted for about 10 years. I'm telling you, the joy of being a vehicle of blessing financially was incredible. And my daughters were able to, well, over the whole time, they took out some loans, and then their grandparents came through and said, we want to cover a lot of their expenses. And lo and behold, my daughters all went to the school of their choice, and they graduated, and they're working. And Tiffany even said, "Daddy, I made my last payment last week, so their debts are all done, and we're still here. It's a miracle. God overflowed my vats with wine, and my barn was filled with plenty. May he do this for all of us. Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, Proverbs 14, but he who is generous to the needy honors him." So whenever you consider someone who has less than you and you reach out to them with your finances, what are you doing? You're honoring your maker. And if you don't, you're insulting him. The reason why, Liz, is because when you give to a poor person, a person who doesn't have your finances, what you're acknowledging, what you're really stating with that gift is, this person, God, is equal to me. You made that person and you made me, and we're both equally human. And I don't deserve to walk around with a better car or better food or a better house and this person suffer, or to extend this on, you know, I don't want them to suffer any more than they have or whatever. And I want to make things more equal by giving some of what I have and helping that person, because I see them as your creation just like you created me. Job said that. Job, if you look at the book of Job, I think it's somewhere in the middle when he's defending himself against the accusations of his three friends. He says, "Look, I took the orphan in and I treated her like she was my own daughter. And my servant, I've let them eat my food, and I've given them the wool for their clothing and everything. Did not the one who made me make also them?" So Job saw even his employees or his servants as equal in terms of their humanity and their worthiness of help. He who is generous to the needy, he honors his maker. But he who oppresses a poor man, you insult his maker. Because you're saying, "Oh, this guy doesn't deserve my attention or my kindness." Again, in Proverbs 19:17, "Whoever is generous to the poor, he lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed." That's pretty nice. If you want to make a loan to God, think about that. He might come back with some good interest for you, right? God will surely pay you back. Number 5, Jesus taught us to put our treasures in heaven. "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and thieves don't break in and steal. Because where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also." Okay, so let me explain something here. He's not saying that you should not have a bank account or you shouldn't invest in a house or whatever you have to invest your resources. That's not what he's saying here at all. When I think about it, Karen reminded me, she goes, "You know, today, we're barely going to make retirement with the current savings that we have. We got to keep saving. So we're going to maybe work till we're 67. We don't know. But we want to be responsible to have enough money coming in monthly that we don't have to go to our kids and say, please help us out." So what do? You have to have several $100,000 saved, right? You have to have something there so you can draw on your 401k or draw on something. We don't own a house. So these kinds of things of preparing for your own retirement, that's not, I don't think, that is what Jesus is saying here. But what he's saying is, beyond what you need to live and have your insurance and you know, do your travel or whatever you're going to do, beyond that, if you just keep hoarding and hoarding and putting in more and saying, "This is my life," and pretty soon, before you know it, your investments take over your heart, because then your heart is in this world and not in the next. And my plan is, Manuel, that by the time I die, I will have spent my last $5, you know. Like, "Okay, girls, here I am. Give me one more Starbucks and the rest, you know." And I don't even understand people that wait till they die to give their trust. It's like, I want to give it before. I want to see how much they enjoy the money that I have, right? I'm going to give it away but try to time my death right there so I can finally just go without anything. So anyway, he says, don't, I mean, if you just think, when you have treasure in heaven, then you can hardly wait to go there. That's my whole point. When I thought I was going to die of cancer, I had one good thing. Terry, one thing that really helped me through that time, besides my tears and all that stuff, I kept thinking, I know I'll see. I don't have any regrets about what I did with my finances. I honored the King of Kings with my money. And it had been for not just 5 years, it was since the time we got married. We were 22 when we got married. 42 years of serving Christ and serving him and finding ways to use the money to get the most out of it for the Lord's sake. Okay, 6, John the Baptist taught us to also share our wealth with the poor. The crowds asked him, "What then shall we do if we repent and follow the kingdom of God?" He said, "Well, whoever has two tunics is to share with him who has none, and whoever has food is to do likewise." So one of the best ways you can find out, should I help this person or not, is, do they have something that I consider to be a pretty important thing, and I have two of them? Then why not let go of one? You know, John Baptist was not asking them to become poor, that someone else would become rich. No. He was saying, if you have something extra, why not share it? Karen and I, I have three cars. For the first time in our marriage, we have three cars that are all paid off, and we don't need three cars. So that little white car out there, what is it, a Hyundai Elantra, 2010, I think. It's got 200,000 miles on it. A lot of those miles were benevolence miles. I didn't drive them. Olga drove them, and now Frank Schifani and Michael Donnell for a while. And whoever happened to need a car, it was so much fun to be able to say, we have a car. It's just sitting in the parking lot at church, at Bethany Church. Here's the keys. Go take it. Use it. It's been a joy for me to do that. And if we had a house, we'd do the same thing, or if we had apartments or whatever. But our little extra resource currently is an extra car, a third car. By the way, it's not available because Frank has it right now. So, but Frank's doing some really good things with that car. He's driving to help these youth and his work, and we're so happy that they all get the benefit. Number seven, the early believers were known for their remarkable generosity. Now, the full number of those who believed were of one heart and soul. This is from Acts chapter 4. And no one said that any of the things that belonged to them was his own, but they had everything in common. And with great power, the apostles were giving their testimony of the resurrection of the Lord, and great grace was upon them all. There was not a needy person among them, for as many as were owners of lands or houses, they sold them, and they brought the proceeds of what was sold and laid it at the apostles' feet. That's a lot of money we're talking about, right? Again, this is not saying, I want to give up $100 a day, or I'm going to give $1,000. These people, like, watch the next one. Joseph, who was called by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. He was a Levite, a native of Cyprus, the island, beautiful island of Cyprus in the middle of the Mediterranean. He sold a field that belonged to him and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. A piece of property in Alhambra is worth probably $300,000 to $400,000, right? If there's no house on it, maybe more. I don't know, depending on how big it is. He sold that kind of thing, and he brought that money in. We're talking about several $100,000s, probably. And it may have been a big chunk of his savings for the future, right? But he thought, you know what? To see these people here in Jerusalem, some of them not having enough clothing on their backs, some of them not getting really good food, I'm going to just sell that property, and I'll trust God to take care of me. And he brought the money, and he laid it at the apostles' feet, and it meant so much to the congregation that everyone knew about it. And Luke actually records the event. He was like the example par excellence of someone who was not tied to this earth, but was seeking heaven and trying to take care of God's people here on earth. There's a really interesting story. Aaron, I'm glad you're here today. Good to see you. When I was in Germany, Aaron, I came across a biography on Karl Marx. And I was so interested in reading about his life. Because they have streets named after Karl Marx, you know, in Berlin. It's Karl Marx Straße and stuff like that. They still have kind of a high view of him. But, you know, his father was Jewish. He was a Jewish family. His father was a lawyer, an attorney in Amsterdam or Rotterdam, one of the Holland cities. And he wasn't having enough clients. So he went to a church and was baptized as a Christian so that he could get more clients. And his son was raised with this kind of a shallow faith, a faith that, you know, to get money, I'll go there and get baptized, I'll be a Christian, I'll convert. And it was known that he did it for his clientele, so that he could work for Christian people. Karl Marx was sent to a Jesuit school at the age of 16. He had to write a paper on the unity of the apostles and Jesus from John 15 through 17. The vine and the branches. He studied the Bible. Karl Marx knew the scriptures. And the year after he did that, he said to his dad, I don't believe in God. I don't want anything to do with that. And when you see his writings and when you realize what direction he went, he must have, in my mind, I think he saw this passage here, just a few pages past John 17 or 15. And when he saw right here, because they would have had him read a lot of the New Testament, he probably saw this is like utopia. There's not a needy person among them. They all sold these things. They brought the proceeds of what was sold, laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as he had need. Wow! How is that possible that a whole society of several thousand people, and there's not one poor person among them because they're all giving, and the apostles were coordinating the giving so that everyone had what they needed. And he thought, I'll do this without God. I will find a way to create utopia financially without the Holy Spirit. The Politburo will do it. I'll find a way to do that. And so he invented communism. We just take from the rich and we give it to the poor. We don't give them a choice, right? And what did we just read? We read God hates. He loves a cheerful giver. He only wants someone to give when they want to give. He does not want you to be forced to give. The last thing he wants is for you to take from someone that doesn't want to give it to you and say, I'm sorry, I'm taking your home and now belongs to the state. And you can go, you know, or your farm now belongs to the state and we'll make sure that the poor people get it. And here, you poor people, here's some extra money for you or extra food for you. And as in the words of Winston Churchill, communism makes sure that everyone is equally miserable. That's all they can do, right? Bring everyone down to the same level because we can't have anyone rich and poor. That's just, any class distinctions is anathema. And God had a far better way. No, I speak to the hearts of the rich and they willingly give to the poor. And the poor and the rich are united as a brother and sister. That was God's intent. That's why he made the rich and the poor. It says in Proverbs, the Lord made everyone, including the rich and the poor. The rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the creator of them both. Okay? So that tells you something. Debbie, God intends to have people of different economic strata be part of his community. It's part of his plan. It's part of his purpose that we don't have all rich people and we don't have all poor people. And Alhambra is actually a kind of a nice place, right? We're not really particularly rich. We're not particularly a low-income place, but we have people from different places, from East L.A., from San Marino. We have people from all over, right? And we are here, we're equal. Here we all come to take the Lord's table together, the elders included. There's nobody that has a higher rank here. Everyone is the same. We are all sinners in need of God's grace. And when there's a brother or sister that I care about who has something, that they're lacking something and I haven't, Lord, let me free my heart to give it to them and have the joy of knowing that I was able to supply this need. And that person, guess what? They're grateful to you. It's like, wow, you didn't need to do that. Oh, no, I wanted to do it. Oh, well, that's so nice of you. Thank you. And so we have this incredible bond and unity that happens when you have disparate incomes, but a loving heart and a free will, a heart of unity to help the people that are part of the church. Karl Marx, man, when you take out the Spirit of God and you try to imitate the Spirit of God and that which only the Spirit can do, the fruit of the Spirit, and you do it with government, with guns, with terrorism, with oppression, you end up with millions and millions who had to die so that they could keep that philosophy going. Whenever someone says, well, what about socialism? You know, I have friends that are socialists or some have socialists or whatever, and I just say, please, would you just go visit Venezuela or go to, I was in East Germany before they changed, right? Karen and I saw it. We went through Checkpoint Charlie. We saw what it was like to go into a cafe in East Berlin and they said, wir empfehlen Gulaschsuppe, which means we recommend goulash soup. And then they gave me a menu. So I said, well, how about this? And they said, oh, no, we don't have that. Well, how about this? No, sir, we said goulash soup. I go, oh, I guess I'll have goulash soup. And then there was all the Cokes and the different things. No, there's only orange soda this week. The whole nation of East Germany had orange soda for 1 week. And then the factory changes it the next week. So that's all you get. Oh, my goodness. That was the best form of communism. East Germany was the best country. Then there's places like, you know, Romania and Ceausescu and Russia and all the other places. Albania. Albania was just incredible. I've been there, too. I just wish people that think you can force and take money away and that it's the government's job to do that they would just visit. Please visit two or three of these countries who do that all the time and tell me how you like it there. Tell me how the people are faring. Tell me what's the work ethic of the laborers who build the cars. You know, when we went to East Germany, there was only one car, the Trabant. And it was big enough to fit two little people in the front. And they had to wait 7 years before they could get a couple that got married. Had to wait 7 years until they could get their one car that was enough for two people. Oh, my goodness. Because I remember when we drove a Volkswagen Golf, which was the smallest Volkswagen, it was huge compared to their Trabant. I thought, how is that possible? There's something smaller than a rabbit or a Golf, you know. But okay, number 8. God takes into account each act of generosity. At Caesarea, in Acts, this is Acts 10, the man named Cornelius. We're going to look at him. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort, a devout man who feared God with all his household. And watch this. He gave alms generously to the people and prayed continually to God. Those were the two main things that Luke wants us to know about this man. I mean, he feared God with his household, and he was a devout man, and he gave alms and prayed. So about the 9th hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God come to him, and he said, Cornelius. And he stared at him in terror and said, what is it, Lord? And he said to him, your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. He was watching every single time he helped a poor person, every single time he helped finance the building of the synagogue, every single time he quietly gave here and there. And the Lord said, you know what? It's finally reached such a point in heaven that it's time for me to send the prince of the apostles. Peter himself is going to come and give you a message. You and your household are going to be saved. I want you in heaven and everyone that belongs to you. And he was the first Gentile. He was the first non-Jew to make it there, Eli. And the thing that touched God's heart was that he prayed. He took time to pray and honor God. He took time and he took of his finances and he gave to the people. He saw the same heart of Abel in Cornelius. And he wasn't even a son of Abraham. They have ascended, your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. So David, if you ever think about the losses that you've gone through financially, you can just put that to the side and just think about the ways you've given. And remember, God has taken note of every single penny, every single dollar, every single thing you gave up to help with his work and his people. Number nine, lastly, we will reap what we sow. And this is an amazing chapter. If we had time, we could go into it as a whole sermon maybe, but that's not today. But 2 Corinthians 9, Paul is talking to the Corinthians about collecting a collection of funds so that they could take it to Jerusalem and help the poor people in Jerusalem, because there was a famine that was going on there. Mario, there was a drought in Israel, but not in Greece. Okay, so there was a time where the people in Israel had less and less food, and people in Greece and in Turkey, or that area today in Asia Minor and in Macedonia, where they had enough to eat and they had a little bit surplus. So Paul says, you know what? This is a wonderful opportunity. I'm going to have these Gentile churches collect a fund, and we're going to take one man from each church, and he'll take the money with him, and we'll bring it all the way to Jerusalem and give it to the poor of Jerusalem, because that's what Peter and John had asked him. He said, please, we don't ask you to keep any of our Jewish laws. We only ask you to remember the poor here in Jerusalem. You know how many thousands of people we have? We probably have a church. By that time, the church must have been 100,000 people. And they had a lot of people that were poor, and they could not feed them all. And do you know that Paul was ready, willing to die to go back to Jerusalem and send that gift? That's how important it was to him. So he said, I want you to know, brothers, about the... He's telling now the Corinthians. Now they're in Achaia, but he's trying to stir them up by the example of Philippi, Lydia and her team, and Thessalonica and Berea. So he says, I want you to know, brothers in Corinth, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. For in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty have nonetheless overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, that was based on what they had, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints in Jerusalem. Now that is a willing spirit. They were begging us, they were entreating us, saying, please, Paul, don't go by. Make sure we are included in your gift. We want it. We're going to start right now. We're going to take our months. We want desperately to be part of the people who gave to our brothers and sisters in Jerusalem, because they were so kind to not force us to become Jews. We want them to know that we're equally there with our love for them, and we want to give them back something from our blessing. They give us the spiritual riches. We want to give them physical riches, material riches. And so the point is this. He said, in this, not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then by the will of God to us. Then he says, the point is this. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Right? If you sow a little bit of seed, you'll get a little bit of grain. If you sow a lot of seed, you'll get lots of grain. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly and not under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. And then he makes a very interesting statement. Here, this is the principle I want to close with. As it is written, he has distributed freely. The righteous man is given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. And then he says this, God, who supplies the seed to the sower and bread for food, he will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. So what he's saying is this, the God who gives us the whole process of sowing and planting and then watering and everything and then finally reaping and finally making bread from it, grinding in the flour and making it into bread, that entire process of bringing it from seed to food on the table, that belongs to God. He does everything. He makes sure you have this. He makes sure you get all the way here. And so the God who does that, who supplies seed and then gives us food, bread at the end, he will allow you as, now he's not talking about us as farmers here, he's saying in your harvest of righteousness, he's saying in your good deeds to other people, in your gifts to other people, you will have the same joy that a farmer gets when he brings it all the way to the table. You will be enriched in every way to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God, for the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but also is overflowing in many people thanking God. And he talks about the Jewish people now. By their approval of this service, of your gift, the Jewish people in Jerusalem will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ. And the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others, while they long for you and they pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God upon you. Thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. So Paul was excited because he knew this was the one time in history that he could see and ensure that the Jewish and the Gentile church would be united. It was done through finances. This group of people, a large group of people, had a big need. And this group of people, a small group of people, but were sincere. They didn't have a lot of money, but they gave. They gave so much that we could see, I think, that he showed up with probably $7 million worth of today's money. Because it had such an impact on the church at large, it had to be several million. You couldn't do that with just a couple hundred thousand. It had to be millions that by the time they came from Corinth, from Achaia, from Berea, from Athens, from Thessalonica, from Philippi, and then not to mention all the Asian minor churches. He had a lot of churches, and there was a whole team that went with him. So everyone carried his bag of gold or silver with him to give to the saints in Jerusalem. Wow. So here's the thing. The way Paul sees it, I think here I have written here Joel Osteen. Joel Osteen, how many have heard him on the TV? Half of you maybe? So Joel Osteen is a very, very eloquent preacher, right? He's very careful about the way he puts together every sermon. He practices it and does it just perfectly. But Joel Osteen has a view of giving that is different than what Paul is describing here. Paul is saying, he doesn't say here, now that you've given, I'm praying that God will make you rich. He didn't say that. He said, now that you've given, oh, you're going to get so much back, you guys are going to be really well off. Because that's a sign that God's blessed you when you're well off. He did not say that, Lupe. He says, you know what? I'm so excited because of your giving and their giving. You will be enriched in every way to be generous in every way. Why do you get more from God? It's so that you can continue the cycle of giving. What he's talking about here is his prayer. And this is what he said to the Philippians. The same exact thing he says to them after they gave their gift. He says, "I may God enrich you for every good work." So in other words, Joel Osteen sees it like if you give to God, you'll give back and then you'll get a better house and maybe a better car. Or maybe 5 cars like I do, or 7 cars, or maybe a multi-million dollar mansion like I have. What did he get, $20 million on his book as an advance? Just one book. Before he even sold one thing, he got millions. He's a very well-to-do man. I'm not even trying to fault him for that, but I'm just saying his theology when it comes to this verse is not biblical. He's taking one element where God says, look, if you give to me, your vats will overflow with new wine. But guess what? God did not send me that stock, Eli, so I could become rich. That wasn't the purpose of it. It was so that my girls could go to school and I could get them all up and running. And here I am back in the same place where we were before. Karen and I work, we give a tithe, and with our tithe we can do all kinds of things. And we love to give. And Karen teases me because every now and then, like last week, I got a, what is it called? Honorarium. I preached at Bethany Church, they hand me a check. Oh, I said, no, I don't need it. She said, yes, you're going to take it. Okay, fine, I'll take it. This is going to go to our Mexico team youth. And a couple weeks ago, I spoke in Monterey Park. They gave me a gift. So this is going to go to our youth going to Mexico. So guess what? That's where we can spend all this money on this lunch today, and then you get to enjoy it, right? And Karen's always saying, I see you got an honorarium because I see you grinning, and you're just wondering who you're going to give it to today. The reason I don't keep it is because I'm already salaried. I already have a salary from you. And I feel like if I go preach somewhere, that's part of what my job is, right? And if they give me money, then I'm getting extra money. That's not right. So that's why I give the honorarium to whatever, another staff member that has less, like Matt Kettle, or maybe someone who's volunteering their time so much, or whoever needs it. But here's what I want to conclude with. And I want to be transparent with you. We wanted to tell you a report. We don't have the whole report yet. Debbie and I will work on this, but I can tell you this. In 5 years' time since I've been here, we started out with about $130,000, something like that, $130,000 to $140,000 in the bank in different CDs and investments. And now we're down to a little bit over $100,000. So as Alejandro put it to me, Chris, we're going down about $5,000 a year. That's what we're doing. About $400, $500 a month that we keep slipping, going into the red a little bit. Not that we're in debt. We still have 100,000 saves, but I just don't feel good about that. I don't want to continue this thing. I mean, I have the same income I had back then. I've not asked for an increase in wage. The only thing we've increased was we told Matt, we want to pay for your medical now. So starting this year, we paid for medical. So that's $220 a month. That's not a lot. But what I want you to know where we are so you can decide yourself. Do I want to focus more of my giving on Gateway itself? Because my prayer is that this would be the first year we would be in the black the whole year and that we'd start uphill and not keep going. I just don't like to drain our savings like that. We are almost there, but I just think it would be wonderful if we had a surplus. And especially, I'm thinking maybe one day Matt might get married. Maybe. And if he gets married, it'd sure be nice if he could afford his own apartment. And not that he has to go to Duarte or San Dimas, but maybe in Alhambra, right? It'd be cool if we could live right here in Alhambra as a married man with his MDiv and continue to work, maybe even work 40 hours a week. So I'm not even thinking about myself. I'm ready to retire, Debbie. I'm going to be out of here pretty soon, you know, as far as finances. But Matt, I'm really thinking about because he is my dear brother, and I've told Karen so many times, I said, if I ever am given a point of leadership in a church and I have a role to play in saying what someone earns, I am, with all the power that God gives me, I'm going to make sure that man is paid right. That includes my dream is that one day he would have a 401k or a 403c, whatever it is, and he'd have his insurance, and he'd have an income that is appropriate for someone who has 2 degrees. I just think it's right. And then we won't be ashamed before the Lord. We can say, Lord, when you gave us a gift like Matt Kettle, we took care of him, you know. And so, but we can't do it now. We can't undo anything without having, being in the black. But that's my prayer. It's just my prayer. And I know when God speaks to people, they will, with free hearts, they'll say, I want to give to this thing here. I want you to know I have spent 5 years and I've tried to be the example by giving from what we have. Karen and I have given and given and given more. And everything we have, except for Ed Portillo in jail, who was a member here, everything goes to you guys. Everything in one way or the other. It's there to bless you. It's there to help you. It's there to help build up the church. When Steve turned it over to me and Juan and Kenny Completo, the first thing I thought is we need to eat more often together. And so I just spent a lot of money on food. That's all I did. I have another luncheon. Let's do it again. And that was good and healthy for us. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're going to enjoy this luncheon. Thank you for hearing me out today. Thank you for letting me be one of the elders here and for paying me. You pay me well. I get 20 hours a week and you pay me $30 an hour and I'm very satisfied with that. And I use that and Karen's income and a little bit from my mom, caring for my mom. And with that, we can live and we can be a blessing to this congregation. So I ask you, will you join me to do that same thing and have the joy that I have when I see the church change over time, the church growing, the people changing their lives, the youth taking on more and more responsibility and going over to Mexico? What a joy to participate in the work of the Lord. That's the joy of giving.